Okay, a bit of go, I'll make up the start. I had a right laugh the other week. I spoke to a mate of mine, he said he was doing anarchist book fair, he might have heard this before. He was doing anarchist book fair, and I said I could do a little talk on social crime. Bless his cotton socks, he actually believed me. So here I am, done a bit of research, and I thought I'd come and... First off, what I was going to do is talk about the law, the legal system, where's it come from? I mean, we ought to know, really. I mean, let's face it, we live under it. It affects our lives and everything we do, just about. From what we can do in our day-to-day interaction with our families and such like, to actual interaction with actual wider society. But, like, basically, where did the law come from? First off, we were all living in caves, weren't we? Yeah, all getting on very happily. And obviously, there's some moral or ethical... Mate, say what I mean. Well, there's some moral and ethical crimes that would never, ever be socially acceptable, like murder, rape, and let's face it, robbery, face-to-face robbery. I mean, we've got the anarchist book fair downstairs, you know, no laws, you know, we all come from the same cut of cloth, no one's nicking off each other, we don't need to do that, you know, so where did it all come from? I'm afraid I'm going to give a little bit of a Marxist, classical Marxist interpretation on dialectic. I agree with most of what he says, it's just the gulags and the mass shooting where it goes a bit tits up. But like, basically, what he states is, there was a state of surplus value. We was all living in caves, we were getting on lovely jubbly. Everybody was sort of going out hunting, gathering and such likes, and as soon as somebody started to grow crops and started to have a bit of surplus, they started to build fences. And once they start to build fences, people who are outside the fence want to know what's inside the fence. You know, it's all about this, it's all about wealth and the haves and have-nots. Moving swiftly on from that, going on to Saxon times. Hello, comrades, you all right? There's loads of chairs around here if you want to come sit down. Should we have some more chairs, mate? There's the old Saxon folk move. Has anybody heard of a folk move?
No. Yeah, it's common.
Yeah. Well, it's common. It's common. Basically, what that was,
it's
not common. In a given locality, the elders, or also sometimes the wealthy, of course, because that's sometimes, they sit down their contracts.
Right, Saxon folk mode, yeah.
So basically what they would do is they'd elect at times, I mean there'd be different arrangements in different areas, you know, at times they'd elect someone, other times it'd just be the tribal chief or the elder or something, and they would come down, they'd have discussions, they'd put over their voices, their views if you like, and go back and enact what they decided on. The actual legal system as such was still very, very, very vague, you know, it was down to the different areas on to enact what they thought was fair. I mean, there was the old, battle by blood, which is basically if you killed a person or robbed off a person, then the families might do battle one against one. There was also other different laws as well, that if you were right out of order, they used to bury you in a bag of snakes. Lovely jubbly, yeah. But like, it all really changed after the Norman Conquest. William the Bastard, as he was known to his colleagues and family, lovingly, came over, as you know, in 1066 with what, for all intents and purposes, was a mercenary army. It wasn't sort of like that he was being followed over here because he felt he had a rightful claim to the monarchy over here. It was like he had a lot of people that were sort of kicking their heels, second sons. As you all know about primogeniture, the first son would take the land and the second son would normally join the clergy or go and become a mercenary somewhere. And it was largely this. It was all sorts of people that came over from the wide slice of the world, as far as Turkey and the Saracens. You know, they came over it, as you know, they won the Battle of Hastings. But not only that, William the Bastard, or the Conqueror, as he's known in some history books, then set about setting up the Doomsday Book. Now, what the Doomsday Book was all about was actually defining who owns what lands. And not only that, more importantly, it was actually taking the land off a lot of people and giving it to Norman robber barons, as a lot of people know this. Now this is still very relevant going on to the English Revolution. I hope some of you heard about Gerard Wynne Stanley and the diggers and the levellers. After the English Revolution, people were still saying, what have we fought for? We're trying to break away from the Norman yoke. You know, the Normans came over, they imposed a monarchy on us, they imposed this land laws on us. And we fought this war and it's still there. It just might not be a king anymore, but we've got the major generals. And more importantly, we've got the people, the landowners, that are still making people work on the land. A few the few taking all the money from the labour of the many. But I do digress, I jump forward a little bit. So, we've got William the Conqueror, let's have a slurp a bit. I set this up, very brutal time as well. You know, I mean, literally for thieving, they could cut your hands off. For vagrancy, I mean vagrancy if you have nowhere to live, they could whip you or brand you on the head with a V. But basically what I'm trying to say here is it became the wealth and such like, it became a differentiation between the have-nots and the haves. And as the classic Marxist interpretation of the dialectic, you know, and the fences going up, the Normans and their sons, and it was invariably sons, I'm sorry sisters, that's the way it was at that time, you know, they would inherit the land and they had to stand firm on the, because basically there'd be a family with a few retainers with sharp swords, and that was very important, that the actual legal system in this country was actually imposed at sword point, I think that's very important, that would actually be running a massive swathe of land and taking a lot of their produce as well, you know, you'd be growing stuff. You'd be trying to feed your kids. The church would have 10% off you in tithes, and the robber barons would have a lot off you. And also, if you didn't go and join with them, they'd have these silly wars and such likes. And underneath feudalism, you were expected to give up a period of your life to go and serve on the Lord's lands, either in these stupid wars or arguments with other robber barons, or digging up his farmlands, ploughing it. So you'd actually be taken away from your land. Now I want to give you a couple of examples of the class bias in the legal system. I'm going to jump about a little bit. One of the first ones is the 16th century, the Statutes of Artifice, which was brought in Henry VIII's time. I probably pronounced it wrong. Somebody helps me out there. But go on, you can if you want.
I was also mentioning the Statute of Labourers.
Yeah, there was. Yeah, absolutely. Both were very important, you're right, in 1381, the Statute of Labours, which was after the Cave Rebellion, wasn't it, and the Statute of Artifices, both had the very same point of view. What happened was, there was the big plague, the bubonic plague, a lot of people died in some cities, where there was a big urban, you know, mass, if you like, up to 60% of the population would die through it, but also in the rural areas, a lot of people died. And what this actually led to was, for the first time ever, the labourers, the workers on the land, could actually choose who they work for. Prior to that, not only did the lord of the manor have the say of where they worked, where they lived, even who they could marry, and in some real bastard landowners, they would actually take the woman on the wedding night. There was actually that as well. You know, so the oppression was very, very distinct. But after the Black Death, there wasn't enough to work the farms. So people were actually going to the highest bidder. They could actually have a choice of where they worked on the wages they were offering. Now, we sort of take this for granted now, to an extent. I mean, I'll get onto trade unionism later. But like, what the Henry VIII and the Edward II Statute of Labourers did was put a price cap on what they could actually ask for. So therefore, that absolutely and totally done away with that. You could no longer actually bargain with your employer. There was a flat rate across the country and all, you know, and that's what you had to work for. There's another one I'd like to talk about as well, which is the benefit of clergy. Has anybody ever heard of that? The benefit of clergy, basically there was a lot of crimes, and some of them were capital as well, where you could actually get away with being prosecuted if you could write or read a passage from the scriptures. There was an actual Psalm 51, where I don't know what that is, I haven't got the faintest idea. But if you could actually read that, then you would actually be let off, and your case would be transferred to the court at the monastery. I can't say the word, ecclesiastical court. Could somebody help me out with that?
Ecclesiastical.
Thank you very much indeed. Yes, I'm not very good at pronouncing things, but I know what's going on. And basically, they didn't have the right to hang people. There was no capital crimes heard there. So the worst you could do, actually, was get a large fine. And it wasn't until 1489 that they actually took murder, rape, and armed, you know, highway robbery off the benefit of clergy. So before that time, if you could read and write, you could get away with murder. Literally, you could beat your own servant to death and get away with it if you could read a passage out of the Psalms. And they'd send you off to the monastery, give you a nice pat on the head, and send you on your way. Now, as I'm sure a lot of you are aware, the vast majority of the population had no access to any education. You know, the only book that was widely read was the Bible, and all that was all in Latin. All the church services were in Latin. You know, a lot of stuff was done word of mouth. As I'm sure most of you are aware, a lot of the bargaining was done face to face, a lot of transactions, you know, selling your produce and such likes. But the only people who could read were either the clergy, who had been brought up in scholastic schools, or those people who actually could afford to send their kids off, or actually get a private tutor in to teach them how to read or write. Or those people also that when their sons, and it was invariably sons, dropped themselves in the plot by murdering someone, could actually hire someone to teach them how to read this psalm. So they could do it by rote fashion. Another thing I'd like to bring up as well is the capital crime of sheep stealing. It was made capital in 1741. And what I mean by capital crime is you can actually be taken to court and hung by the neck until dead for caught stealing the sheep. Yeah? Now the thing about sheep stealing, yeah, was okay, it was very much a rural economy at the time and a lot of people had sheep, but it wasn't an organised crime. It was normally a crime of hunger. You couldn't, I mean, with cattle rustling, a similar sort of thing, but you wouldn't be able to normally get away with a whole flock of sheep. Someone would spot you, wouldn't they? Or hear you. You're in the middle of the night and there's all this coming, and you're trying to get all these sheep away. You're going to get yourself nicked, aren't you? Most sheep, also, I didn't say about the time, 1741, also a great dearth in the country at the time. A lot of people were actually starving to death. You know, you could actually be sitting there watching your kids starve to death. And meanwhile, there's food out there. So what are you going to do? You're going to go and get it, aren't you? And a lot of the actual sheep stealing, the sheep were not taken, and I do apologise to the animal lives out there, you know, but this is the reality of our history, you know. The sheep would be killed in the fields and probably butchered and parcelled up and used. And it wouldn't just be, at times, it wouldn't just be taken back to that person's house, but it would actually be handed out. Occasionally, admittedly, it would be flogged to the local butcher. Now, this being made a capital crime in 1741 suggests to me quite strongly that was made a capital crime in response to hunger. Sheep stealing had gone through the roof because people were so hungry they were driven by necessity to do it. Now, I don't normally do a quote, but I think this is quite a good quote. It's from Sir Professor Thor Rogers. I mean, no one knows if we call their kid Thor, but someone did. And he wrote in the 18th century as well, for more than two and a half centuries in English law, and those who administered it were engaged in grinding the English workman, or woman for that matter, I'm going to add that, to the lowest pittance, in stamping out every expression or act that suggested any organised discontent, and in multiplying penalties upon him when he thought of his natural rights. So I'm just going to move on a little bit about social crime and anti-social crime, because you can't put social crime or anti-social crime over there. There's a lot of grey areas. And the first one I'm going to talk about is smuggling. I mean, obviously there's smuggling still going this day and age. And the smuggling of Eastern European or Chinese women and children is obviously completely and utterly unacceptable. There's nothing social about that. It's wrong. However, there's also smuggling, which is general avoidance of unpopular tax as well. And that's what I'm going to talk about a little bit now. There was a lot of tax at the time, you know, and taxes weren't, as today, weren't necessarily seen by the common person as being a benefit. The taxes were largely raised, as Charlie, before we lobbed his head off, to fight unpopular wars. It had nothing to do with the workers. It had absolutely nothing to do. And a lot of the taxes as well was put on stuff that we consumed, you know, basic necessities. There's two things I'd like to talk about at the moment. And one is rum, and the other one is tea. And they were things that were popularly smuggled in. And there was whole organisations behind this. You know, it wasn't just a case of getting an old bottle of rum cheap from Calais and coming back and selling it to your mates. This was a whole organisation which needed a whole community response and understanding and defence, I would argue, as well. But there's also bad parts to it. It was quite brutal. It was quite violent. But for starters, what you would get is you would get For example, with the rum, I mean, obviously rum wasn't necessarily made in this country. There was distillers, and I get on to distilling and growing dope at a later stage. But you had, you'd have a big ship that had been to the West Indies, had hogsheads of rum, and they would be met out in the English Channel or somewhere, a pre-arranged area, and a smaller ship known as a clipper. And a clipper, as the name suggests, was quite fast, quite a speedy little thing. It was actually made for this, you know. I don't know a lot about shipbuilding. I've never built a ship in my life, nor do I intend to. But, like, it was quite sort of narrow, couple of sails on it, a few guns. It wasn't particularly built for defence, even though it would defend. And they were there to nip quickly in and out without the Royal Navy seeing them. Because the Royal Navy, especially in some of the areas I'm talking about, down the south of the country, were very, very, very active. And if they saw a ship, as they do now in the West Indies, the Royal Navy is still out there stopping the coke deliveries. They tell you to stop. If you don't stop, they shoot you. And obviously they didn't have radios, they had all flags and, you know, they did a bit of shouting and what have you. But once they'd done that run, the next thing would be the likes of us in a rowing boat would go out to these clippers and we'd unload these hogsheads. There'd be a transaction there, and then the hogsheads would be rowed in to, hello comrades, into the port, well, not the port actually, onto the beach. And this was something else as well. It avoided the big ports. It went into little coves and such like. We've all heard stories about dragons and trolls and such like living in caves and eating children alive, haven't we? Well, a lot of those stories were brought about to keep children out of the caves, where a lot of the rum, tobacco, tea, sugar, whole host of things were stashed at a holding bay, if you like, because children sometimes would go there, they'd see something, and unfortunately they'd give it in the wrong area, and they'd get found out. So a lot of these fairy tales that we hear, even from different countries, were around smugglers trying to keep having a chat around the fire and trying to keep the kids out of the caves. But once they were landed, that was also difficult because there was customs officers, excise officers, and you knew them because they had a black rod. And they would actually have dragoons helping them, and they'd patrol the seafront, basically, the coastline. Easier said than done. Of course, this is the day before walkie-talkies, etc., etc. You know, and they were well outnumbered. And I'm going to get onto it in a bit about the community and such like, you know, but they weren't particularly liked. They were underpaid. A lot of them were paid on what they could actually get back for the excise. And to be perfectly honest, most of them would take a couple of shekels and look the other way. But once it was landed, the next thing was to spread it out. And there was big, massive organisations, as there are now with the yardies, etc., etc., on beaching the stuff and then getting it out to the different taverns and inns, local vicars, local bigwigs. There was a lot of people who brought the rum, the tea and the tobacco. And there was a massive excise on them. In fact, the tea especially, because we've got to remember in this day and age, water wasn't particularly clean. It wasn't particularly nice to drink either, you know. You were better off boiling it, and you were far better off boiling it and sticking a bit of tea in there if you wanted to actually digest it properly. And most people who worked would drink what was known as small beer or cider or tea. I mean, and tea with the excise would be right out of their pockets. But like over time, so I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the Hawkhurst gang that operated down West Sussex way. And the Hawkhurst gang were very, very organised. And what they basically did, they'd land a load of tea, and they were driving. They were on coach and horses, you know, had big wagons, load of the tea, and they were riding through this particular village. And all the locals had come out, and they were literally clapping them. I mean, these were local heroes. So they were against the excise, they were against the taxes and such likes, and they were clapping them. And as they were going through, they were throwing out packets of tea. They could afford to do that. And there was one geezer that they threw a packet of tea to, who got clocked by a local informer who gave the name. And the customs officers went round to his own house, collared him, and said, you know, you are, and actually caught him with his tea and said, you are in possession of smuggled tea. You know, you're going to go to Australia for 7 years, or maybe get hung by the neck, unless you go King's Evidence. And they bullied him into going King's Evidence. And, I mean, this is part of it. I mean, going back to social crime, like I said earlier, there are nasty bits in it. And they were transporting this bloke, for all intents and purposes, was an innocent victim. of A, knowing the smugglers, and B, getting caught knowing the smugglers. And they were transporting him to a magistrate's in Salisbury to give evidence, to give King's evidence. And the Hawkers gang caught them and the customs officers on the way. And, cut a long story short, they tortured them. They cut their ears off, cut fingers off, and eventually ended up throwing them down a well where they were never to be seen again. And they did actually get caught, and a load of them got hung. However, the smuggling trade carried on. There was no change in the smuggling trade. Just some new people took it over, as it is for this day and age. You know, when someone gets bubbled for selling a bit of herb, whatever, they might end up in Orfield. There's always someone who will step into their shoes. Because there's a lot of people out there that think this is just graphically unfair. It's too much. It's too much to pay. And another thing that spreads to mind, because I would like us to think about also modern day here and there. You know, like the DVD trade. I mean, how much do we pay for a DVD or a CD? You know, and all the covered markets and the car boot sales that flog them off. And you see the old bill down there. Have you heard about Portugal and Spain as well? They've got this new law that they can actually stop you at customs now. And say you've got a Gucci bag or something, they can have it off you now and charge you for the price it would actually cost. And not a proper Gucci bag, sorry, one you've got from St. Philip's Market or something. And actually charge you the cost it would actually be to manufacture. Well, not the cost it would be to manufacture, because as we all know, it's manufactured in Bangladesh for someone for a dollar a fucking day. You know, but actually charge you the cost price, the retail price. Do you ever know about that? Have you seen that? It's only just hit the fan recently. Right, another one of my favourite social crimes is poaching. I spoke a little bit about social crime. Oh, sorry, about sheep stealing, didn't I? But poaching is very interesting because, as you know, at the time I'm talking about the 17th, 18th, 19th century, the vast majority of people lived in a rural area. They either worked on the land or lived in the forest or something like that, you know. And times were bloody hard. You know, when there was hardship, when the harvest failed, everybody bloody suffered. You know, because your wages would not cover the price of bread. I mean, I've seen some historical reports where you see the increase in the cost of bread, and it's astronomical. It can go up 200-300% in a space of a year. And when bread was a staple diet, I mean, I'm talking about people who were earning 7 to 10 shillings a week, you know, and a loaf of bread, or a couple of loaves of bread would take up most of that. And if bread went up 200-300%, they could no longer afford meat for their children. And on the other hand, as I said, it's a rural area. We've got rabbits hopping about, we've got all sorts, we've got deers and such like, you know. You've got your own bit of land, and there's these rabbits hopping past you. But you weren't allowed to hunt, to actually get a licence to hunt anywhere in the country. You needed an annual income of £100 from your landholdings. Now, as I just said, most labourers on the land got 7 to 10 shillings, depending on where you lived, per week. £100 is an astronomical amount. I wouldn't like to put it in today's figures, but I think we're talking about £100,000 roughly, you know, a lot, you know. So, you'd be sat there in your own garden, there'd be a rabbit coming in, nibbling your lettuce, and you weren't allowed to kill it by law, or you could be hung by your neck after 1723. I'll go back to 1723 and the Black Acts in a minute. And there's a specific reason why it's called a Black Act. So, there was a lot of things happened there. There was lots of different response to this graphically unfair law. For example, there's necessity. There's a single person, or sometimes a family or a couple of people, who needed to go out poaching for the pot. You know, literally to feed their people, feed their family, keep it off. And this day and age, I mean, we all see rabbits about, don't we? When we're going to the countryside, especially, like, not if they see us first, obviously, but, you know, if we're lucky. But in that day and age, it was abundant with wildlife. And also, I mean, going back to the levellers and the diggers, it was still quite a religious time. You know, people were starting to read the Bible because it was printed in English. And in the Bible it says, apparently, I've never read it myself, but apparently, the land is for all. It's a common treasury. You know, God, if that's what you believe in, made everything for everybody. And then the law of the land was telling them something completely different. If you take this for your pot, we'll hang you by your bleeding neck. And then try to feed your family. You know what I mean? So people would gather together in little groups and go out and poach. and they would take animals, they would take them back, they would skin them, they'd use the skin for clothes or building, or sometimes during the really bad days, after the state repression, they'd have to get rid of the skin and just eat the meat. But even the bones you could use for different things around the house, you know, even pins at times, you know. Or you can make spoons out of bones and stuff, implements, stuff like that, you know. I know it sounds a bit prehistoric, but when you ain't got a lot of money, you need to use whatever you can lay your hands on. And they'd eat the produce. But another, there was also organised gangs. And this really came to a head as well, after various wars. There's a lot of studies that have gone around in historical circles that show what happens after a war. I mean, I suppose a lot of you know that war can be very profitable for the ruling classes. It can be profitable for a number of reasons. Not only do they murder a lot of us and keep their hat on us, if you like, domestically, but also there's big industries, and Bristol especially. I mean, during the Napoleonic Wars and such like, there was a shipbuilding industry, brass for cannons, there was the weavers that were making soldiers' uniforms and such like. There was a whole industry, as there is today, as there is today. But obviously, at the end of a war, there'd be two different effects of this. The industries have been in decline, but also the soldiers that have been fighting for this, that and the other were being demobilised into a shrinking economic sphere, a shrinking economic market. So there wasn't a work to do for them. So there was a lot of crime, a hell of a lot of crime, but also there was also a hell of a lot of poaching. Now, going back into, let's just pick up Napoleonic Wars, just for example. A lot of the regiments were actually built, and I'll go on to the militias in a minute, from your actual area. So, you'd actually be serving on the front line with your brother, your brother's mate, the geezer from next door. You know, you'd know them all. You'd all know them all. And those that survived the carnage of being dressed up like a bleeding cherry and marched into Grapeshot would come back to much the same. In fact, probably worse, but you couldn't get a job. And even worse for those that lost limbs. And also, I don't think post-traumatic stress disorder is a modern thing, you know. I think being marched in, being made to march, rank and file against, must have really done your head in. So there was probably a lot of mental health needs that we don't even recognise now. But also, these people have come back with military training. They had an understanding. I don't know how many of you went downstairs to hear Roger's talk at 11 o'clock this morning about Peterloo, about soldiers actually training people up, actually mob soldiers training people up before Peterloo to go and take Manchester. It was very, very much the same with poaching gangs. They'd be done on regimental levels, they'd be very well clued up, and there would actually be a guerrilla warfare. And there's been a couple of books that have actually looked at the poaching wars, if they're called, because it's across the country, along a fray. It was very close to a civil war, because the responsible landowners, and this is something else, we've got to remember, the landowners can't fucking eat it all. It's impossible. I mean, all they're doing is saying, this is ours, but you can't have it. There was nothing paternalistic about it whatsoever, you know. So basically, they set up a response. I mean, once again, there was the mob soldiers that would be taken on as gamekeepers. They would get the magistracy to bring the militia in. There'd be servants of the landowner and such like. So they'd be defending his and occasionally her property against the incursions of poachers. And this went on and on and on. And it's got quite sophisticated as well, because the gamekeepers were setting them, and you've seen all these massive bear traps, you've probably been to rural museums, you know. That could take someone's leg off. I mean, in that day and age as well, the chances of you surviving something like this before the tetanus injection were minimal. Very, very small. The best hope is you just lose your leg. There's a strong possibility if you didn't get it. And also, if you went to a doctor, they'd want to know, especially if they're part of the ruling classes, you know, they'd want to know how you got this wound in your leg in the first place. But also from our side, you know, from the poaching side, we were quite clever about it as well, you know, the traps and such like that we set up, you know. So there was this juxtaposition, this class war, if you like, going on in the forests of England in the 17th, 18th and 19th century, you know, all around trying to live. And it's not surprising there were soldiers from them, but also so were butchers. Has anybody ever read E.P. Thompson's Wigs and Hunters? Very good book, very, very good book. And this basically goes on about the poaching laws. But he also writes extensively about the state's response to this. Because, to be perfectly frank with you, the ruling classes were losing control. They couldn't do it, the same as the customs officers. There was just too much land for them to patrol, or police if you like. And the poachers were winning. So basically what they did is in 1723, over a couple of months, there were over 220 crimes that were made capital offences. 220. So they could hang you by the neck until you were dead for these crimes. And the reason why it's called the Black Act is because one of the most ridiculous reasons you could get hung is for what's known as blacking up, which is actually getting soot, put it over your face, as a disguise to go out at night and getting caught with a black face. So they could actually hang you for that. I mean, chimney sweeps must have shat themselves, you know. But poaching goes on, and it still goes on to this day. I mean, I still know a few people in Arcliffe and Western Supermare who've got a couple of lurchers, and they replenish their pot. But also, it wasn't just necessity, and as I said, there's a grey area, thin line if you like, between what is social crime due to necessity, and also when you get too many rabbits for your pot and you actually start to sell it, so then it's actually financially beneficial to you. Right, I'm going to talk a little bit about riots now, if that's alright. And there's lots of different riots. Sorry. One of the first riots I'm going to talk about, I mean, I suppose a lot of you know about this, but I mean, Britain was quite well known in the 16th, 17th, 18th and 19th century for being quite a rebellious lot. We liked a good knees up, we liked a good jig around the maypole, we liked to sink a couple of pints of cider, but also when we were pissed off, we enjoyed a bit of collective bargaining by riot. There was lots of different reasons why we would riot, and I'm going to go through them. I'm up for questions as well, if anybody wants to ask anything, I'm fine for that. But one of the first things I'd like to talk about is the militia riots. Now, the ruling class had this really bright idea, because after the New Model Army and the English Revolution, we didn't have a standing army as such. You know, a lot of people were forced into joining the army by the King's Shilling and all that. In fact, do you ever see the old pewter tankards that have got the glass bottle? Do you know what that's all about? The pewter, that's right, a pewter glove. I mean, before glass and whatever, well, there was that glass, but it used to have pewter glass, yeah. Pewter mugs, the glass bottle. Because what the recruiting sergeant used to do, he used to come round, buy you a pint, and drop a shilling in it. You just drink your pint, and if you got to the bottom of it and found the shilling, you were actually recruited into the army. And the press gang was a bit different, they just knocked you over the head. But like this was seemed to be as a bright idea. So the glass bottoms, so you could see at the bottom, and to make sure there weren't a shilling in there, and you ended up in Flanders Fields getting shot at with a grape shot. But that was abroad. But how did they actually keep the lid on civil disobedience within England? It was the Militia Act, 1763, I believe it was. And what the Militia Act actually did was give parishes the right, or the power, should I do, to raise their own militia. And what they would do is they would draw lots and pick 100 people. Now that seems quite democratic, doesn't it, in some ways. In a lot of ways it isn't. Because if you got picked by lots, you could either pick a substitute, and if you're a landowner, I'd say you'd probably get a substitute, or pay a tenner to get out of it. Now if you've got a tenner, that's quite a lot of money in those days. The likes of us had to go and serve. So the militia, not only would you have to serve in the militia and actually shoot on your colleagues, comrades across the country, because that's something else that's very important, is if you were picked as a Bristol militia, you wouldn't serve in Bristol, you'd go and serve somewhere else. I suppose most of you have heard about the 1793 Bristol Bridge riot, where 11 people got shot over the toll gates on Bristol Bridge. That was the Hereford militia who levelled arms and shot at that unarmed riot. So, this was graphically unpopular, not just for that, but for some other reasons. You'd have to go and serve, you'd have to go and drill, you'd have to learn how to fight, and also you might have to go, like the Territorial Army nowadays, you'd have to go and serve somewhere. So, if you're a roofer, or a brickie, or something like that, and it's hard enough anyway, feeding your family, It's going to be even harder if you've got to work away fighting somebody else's battle. So, the militia, when the lots were drawn and what have you, it was far from popular. And there was lots of riots all over the country, but largely up north, funny enough. There's quite a few different geographical regions where riots were more, I wouldn't say popular, but more distinctive, if you like. And the militia riots were far more up north. And I do wonder, even though I don't have any proof of this, if the northern counties were found to be more further away, if you like, from the governance going on in London at the time. Because there were riots in Kent and south east of Britain, but not as many as Lincolnshire and further up. And what they would do at times, where they would get the books, well, they would just tear down whole houses at times of the militia where they were holding these meetings and where they were trying to organise. The same was with the press gangs. Press gangs are very important around Bristol. Excuse me for a minute. Press gangs could literally wander the streets and pick on people they thought as being idle. So you literally could be doing a bit of shopping on a Tuesday afternoon because you're giving yourself a day off, and get knocked over the head, wake up in the hold of a ship, and find yourself fighting someone else's battle out in the West Indies or something. What would happen to your family? God only knows. I mean, this is another reason there was a lot of time and trouble at the time, because a lot of us were just taken to do the ruling class's bit of bidding. And there was a big riot, there was lots of riots against the press gangs. But like, I mean, basically, even I'm a Cockney, I've done a lot of research in Bristol. And in 1870, who knows a Trinity in Eastern? You know, Trinity Nick, and opposite there's a Trinity Church. But just by there used to be a press gang holding place. So basically what they do is they knock people on the head, lock them up there for a bit, and then transport them to the ship. And basically what would happen, I mean, it's akin to slavery. The captain of the ship would come along and sort of say, right, I'm six or seven short, I need this, that and the other. So even if you had a trade, you might have a trade where you're a rope maker. You know, you'd be quids in, well, not quids in at all, but you know, they'd really want you. And the captain, with some soldiers, Royal Marines, would take six or seven people from the press gang area, put them on a ship, and they'd never see their families again. Well, they might do if they were really lucky. And what happened in 1816, sorry. And this, the time is important, and it shows how much people have suffered as well, because it's just after the end of the Second Napoleonic War, after the 100 days of the Battle of Waterloo. And basically what had happened was, there was a general understanding that the press gangs operated in times of war. They would take people to defend these shores. Now, a lot of the likes of us obviously wouldn't agree with it, but there was also some that weren't getting oppressed, if you like, that sort of generally went along with the flow of things. But as soon as the war was over, and they were still being seen as press ganging people and taken away from their families, there was a massive, massive riot. And a load of people got together in different areas of Bristol, converged on Lawford's Gate, and ripped the press gang house down, brick by brick. They broke in first, took the windows out, took the wooden frames out, and took the old place down. And that is quite symbolic as well, because not only did they free the people who had been impressed, but they took the old building down to ensure that it would never operate like that again. And that's something that's very important as well. The rioters, or the people that were rioting in pre-industrial and post-industrial Britain, also they weren't just there for the violence. They also were there to show. You know, I mean, let's get back to hanging, for example. There was a lot of showmanship by the ruling classes around hanging someone by the neck in a very public place. Or the pillory, for example, they put you in the stocks if you've been particularly bad, and people were allowed to throw whatever came to their hands, you know, tomatoes, dead dogs, stones. At times people didn't survive the stocks, particularly unpopular people, including thief takers, which were original bailiffs, if you like, or special constables who got money, and sometimes they were found to be defaulting, they'd get put in the stocks, they'd had it, basically. But, you know, this was a very public display of what would happen if you broke the law. And the funny thing is about hangings, one of the main reasons why they stopped hanging people in the 19th century wasn't because it was brutal or barbaric or anything like that. It's because as a public spectacle to put people off, it didn't actually fucking work. You know, there were big crowds there, and there was lots of pickpocketers working the crowds. You know, because you've got a lot of the working class set up going, ho, 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 look at him being hung. And like then come around, their wallet had gone, so this silk handkerchief and so, et cetera. So it didn't actually work as a deterrent. And also, let's be fair, it's pretty barbaric to see someone hung by the neck and saw their eyes pop out. You know, it's pretty wrong, you know. But our side as well, on the riots, we also had our sense of fate, if you like, of the spectacular. You know, there's something known as rough music, where everybody gets saucepans and such lights and go down to a particular unpopular person, be it someone who reduced wages or something like that, and bang pots and pans outside their house all day. And that's where the burning of effigies started, and we still see this day today, right, you know. In fact, I dare say on Gaza and the West Bank, they're burning the Israeli flag today, so they bloody well should be, you know. But this sort of thing is still was going on then, and that's where it started. And like the riots, they were spontaneous in a way, but also most of the time they were quite well organised. I'm going to talk a little bit about food and bread riots now. Food and bread riots, getting back to starvation, periods of dearth, you know, harvest would fail. At times harvest would fail 2 years in a row. You know, and people were literally starving. I mean, okay, there was the poor law, but there's nothing like the welfare state we have now. I mean, let's be fair, nobody in this room here would bear to see someone starve. But it was so common, unfortunately, in the days I'm talking about. Unfortunately, people did just starve by the roadside, you know. So, when people were charging excess of price, because if harvest failed, you know, the capitalists always go on about demands, and demand was there, but the actual stock was less, so they felt they could put the prices up. Another thing is you still have the capitalists exporting. So there might be people starving in Bristol, they're exporting corn and wheat to Ireland, or even as far as America at times in the early days of the colonies. So there was a couple of different types of riots. Sometimes, and another good thing about this was largely, this was across the community, and there were some riots that were predominantly men. But I'd like to say, and I think the research bears this out, that food and bread riots were largely women. And there's several reasons for this that I'm going to go on to in a minute, remind me. But what they would do is they would turn up at the market with a lot of other people, you know, it grew, the word would go round, Mr. Oggins and Mrs. Muggins, whatever, is selling a loaf of bread at, you know, this price, which is 50% more than they were yesterday. And they'd turn up at the market and go, that's too much, you need to reduce that. And if the person refused, then what they would do is they would seize the loaves of bread and they would go out and they would sell it themselves. Sometimes they would sell it and pocket the money. There were occasions when they'd sell the bread and they'd give the person back, the actual vendor, they'd give the fair price back. So say if they said they should be selling a loaf of bread at a shilling, they'd go out and sell that bread at a shilling and then give the person back a shilling for each loaf that they'd sold. And at times it's been known that they'd even give them back the sacks that the bread was in. So they weren't actually feeding from all the sacks, they were just saying, this ain't right, you know. And E.P. Thompson, sorry to say about him again, but it's quite an important story, called this the moral economy. At times also, and this happened in Bristol and across the country, you know, people would go onto a ship that was destined to export coal, wheat or whatever to another country, and they'd unload that ship. And once again, they'd get all the produce, they'd put it on the quayside, and they'd flog it at a fair price to make sure nobody went hungry. And the thing is the authorities couldn't, but in fact most of the time they had to stand back, because it was so spontaneous. And this is what I'm saying, like at first it was organised, you get a nucleus of people, I'd organise it, and then you get other people to join in, A for a good laugh, and B, because they thought it was right. But the civic authorities, they couldn't stop it. So what they would eventually do is they'd have to partake in it. So basically, this is where you get your first market inspectors who go around and look at the weights and measures to make sure they ain't got a bit of blue tack or whatever the precursor of blue tack was at the bottom of the scales or any shenanigans like this. They should drill out the middle of the weights you know, so you thought you were buying X amount of pounds of this, and actually they had already bottomed out the weight, so it wasn't quite what you were getting. So that was the actual response from the civic authorities. There was lots of other different rights as well. I'm going to talk a little bit. Is this alright, we're going about rights, by the way, yeah? Everybody happy? Sweet as a nut. Toll gates, turnpikes, you ever heard about them? This is, they still got them in France, actually, bless their cotton socks. But like before there was actual sort of any proper municipal authority, you'd get various landowners that would get together and they would seek an act from central government to raise tolls, which is basically a tax of passing, on people who were using a particular stretch of roads. So what they would do is they'd put a toll booth up, a little sort of swing barrier, and they'd charge you on a sliding charge on using the roads. Now, this was graphically unpopular. For starters, the money was supposed to be used for the upkeep and the development of this road, and very rarely it was. Normally it was just trousered by the ruling classes once again. It was just another version of the way they could tax people passing through their lands, as they saw it, their lands, migrants over these lands. So they'd have this fence now. Now at times it would only be for travelling wagons and whatever, so people are actually taking produce to market. But I'm going to have a little chat now about the Kingswood Colliers. It's a very good pamphlet downstairs by the way, in the Bristol Radical History section, if anybody wants to buy it. But I don't move on. About the Kingswood Colliers. So I'll tell you some of the research I've done on Bristol. Bristol, as you know, a port, and the Kingswood Forest was primarily responsible for supplying Bristol with coal. Now, in that day and age, coal was actually essential for the business needs of Bristol, for the industry, from soap making to glass making to making the brass cannons again, yeah? So when the toll was put up on taking the coal into Kingswood, also on the Toghill Road, which was taking the coal to Bath or further afield to London, this was obviously putting a big cost on the Kingswood miners. They weren't rich in the first place. It's bloody dangerous work, working down a hole in the dark, digging coal out, subject to gas, flooding and what have you. When you did get it up, you had to pay a haulier, and if you had to pay extra money for a toll, then that was going to be even more, and that was going to lower the actual amount of money you made out of your coal, and the actual amount of money you'd have to spend on your family or a pint of cider, etc, etc. So they weren't particularly happy about this. So they turned up at the toll gate and ripped it down, completely destroyed it. Not only that, they went around to Bustleton, as it was known there, now known as Brislington, destroyed the toll gates up there, got the miners up, and marched into Bristol, and had a right funky time. They spent a lot of time in various pubs. I mean, there was one time they attacked a parrot. I don't quite know what the parrot did. Probably squawked out a line or said something to Church and King. But they attacked the parrot and threw the landlady in the river, all this sort of business, helped themselves to the cellar, and walked in. I mean, I do feel these pubs were particularly unpopular pubs for one reason or another. There was targeting. But they took the centre of Bristol for a period of time, you know, and they were quite clear. If these tolls continue, you will not have coal. And not only will you not have coal, you'll have us on the streets. So no more toll gates were built in Bristol for about on Bristol to Kingswood side for about 70 odd years. But what Secretary of State, Lord Newgrass at the time, did do, he made it punishable, once again by death, to attack a toll gate. Prior to trade unions as well, there was collective bargaining by right. I'm going to use the Kingswood miners again, but we all know about the Luddites and the Swing Riots. I can talk about them in a bit as well if you'd like. But the Kingswood miners, basically what happened was there was one mine that was a conglomerate of a lot of different mines together, and of course they had more, so therefore if they had more they felt they could cut the costs. The first way they could see by cutting the costs is to cut the wages of the miners, which they did. Now, we all know what happens then. The other mine owners try to keep up, and they start trying to cut the costs, therefore by cutting the wages. So a general rush to the bottom, not for them, but for the likes of us who were cutting the coal out. Now, what happened here wasn't only collective bargaining by riot, but everybody got together, they swore a pledge that they would stand together, and men, women and children went round from right to right, asked them what rate they were going to pay the workers if they came back with a poor excuse or a poor rate. They would get all the stuff at the head. Then first off, they'd make sure that everybody came up. I want to make that perfectly clear as well. They were very clear to the miners. They sent someone down and said, you need to come up now because we're cutting the headgear. Everybody came up. They cut all the headgear, all the windy gear at the top, and they tipped it down the mine. Now, in that day and age, that had been very, very difficult to retrieve all that, and that would put the mine completely out of action for a long period of time. And then what they did, once again, is they set up their own toll gates and extracted fines off local landowners to pay their strike pay. Unfortunately, after much rioting, they got it. There was a halfway house, if you like. The wages weren't reduced the exact amount that the mine owners wanted. There was a common medium, if you like, and there was an agreement on peace rates, and the miners went back to work. 0-0 West Ham, actually. And the miners went back to work. But it did show that collective bargaining by riot could work. And unfortunately, the Kingswood miners, after the arrival of the Wesleyans, and I'm sure you're aware that the Wesleyans arrived in 1738, and they stopped a lot of the riots that were going on. They started trying to do collective bargaining by negotiation, and they were also some of the earlier precursors of the trade union movement, and the friendly societies grew out of the Methodists who did preach down there. But there were still out of the Kingswood miners, there grew some highly organised criminal gangs. But they were criminal gangs, and they weren't all on necessity. They did engage in horse theft and such like, you know. But what's the time, please? How much longer have I got? 5:02. Have I gone on that long? So, maybe I need to wrap up now, because I have been hearing my own voice. I thought it was only about 10 past, honestly. That's a quick synopsis of social crime. I could go on a lot more about common rights and the one-day house and such likes, and about the enclosure acts, the anti-enclosure laws. But like, we've only got 5 minutes. I'd like to throw it to you, because I was hoping to have a discussion. I do apologise profusely about talking too much. I've only got the page 4 as well. Is there any questions or anything you'd like me to expand on? Comrade Alan.
With enclosures similar to the anti-poaching laws, the anti-poaching laws and the closure act, the first ones were not so the landowners could make money. It was to remove any option apart from to work for the landowners for little or no money. They left them fire.
That is so true. By enclosing land, not only did they make money or not, they used that land how they saw fit, but they actually would force people off the commons. I mean, the wealth of the commons must not be near that, you know. Not only was it your passing rabbit, you could probably graze your cow, your donkey, if you were rich enough to own one, but you could also use, you know, woods for fuel, for building, for peat, you know, furs, for, you know, for a whole host of things, nuts and berries. I could go on and on and on about the use of the common lands. Excuse me, if you got kicked off the common lands, your only other option really was wage labour. It's the same fucking farmer who enclosed it in the first place. Alright. Anything else? Right, I'm going to shut up now. I hope you all enjoyed that. I thoroughly enjoyed myself, and thank you very much. Right, Roger, I don't know how to turn this off. Thank you. Oh, that was all right, didn't it? Thank you.